On Sunday nights, we're going to begin because we're just a few days, in fact, from Easter and getting ready for that, really, as Jim said, really the highlight of the Christian year, as, you know, all those holidays, Christmas included, those things are important, but Easter's the one that gives them all meaning, and so we're very thankful for that. Recently, I've been reading through the Gospels and reading about that passion time of Christ leading up to the cross, the crucifixion, the resurrection. And, you know, sometimes just the oddest things sometimes just kind of stand out to you. And what kind of stood out to me was how many times Jesus has ministry on the side of the road, on the way. He's making his way to Jerusalem, as we're going to see here tonight. And on the way, though, he still stops and takes time on the road to teach his disciples, to perform miracles. All of these things are going on. So for the next several weeks, we're really going to be looking at things that happen right by the roadside, right on what I would call his Resurrection Road. That's where he's headed. And so if we, kind of use that as a theme going from here to there, our first stop is the corner of Resurrection Road and Mercy Avenue tonight. I don't know if you're at a point in your life to where you greatly appreciate the mercy of God, but it doesn't take you long to get to that point, does it? We start recognizing what we deserve and who we really are, and boy, I mean, his mercy just becomes overwhelming. The fact that he would love us, the fact that he would die for us, the fact that he would take time out, you know, to have anything really to do with us. The fact that he would stop us in the road that we are going fastly towards destruction and stop us on that very road and minister to us, to call to us, to draw us into his family. You know, I can't help but think, as David writes in so many of those Psalms, who am I that God would take time for somebody like me? And yet I see these occurrences that happen in the Scriptures, and there's a wide variety of people that he meets and ministers to. And it's just a matter of his mercy. You know, I know that there's that verse in Isaiah where it says that the Messiah, when he comes, he will set his face as a flint to head to Jerusalem, to head to the cross, as we see in these passages that are coming. But for him to take time and to stop, to me, are real demonstrations of his mercy. Tonight, we're going to look at two of those occurrences in Matthew chapter 20. One of those is when he stops along the roadside and he shows mercy to his disciples by confiding in them, by sharing with them truth, by taking time to teach. Then he's going to get on down that road a little bit further. He's going to get past Jericho and on his way now a little bit closer to Jerusalem. And he's going to find two blind men that are there that he's going to stop again right by the roadside and take time not just to confide in them great truth, but to have compassion on them and to perform a miracle in their life. Those are the two instances I want us to look at tonight. And since we're dealing with such a variety of verses, we'll just tackle those passages as we come to them. If you're already there in Matthew chapter 20, notice with me in verse number 17, it says, "Now Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them," you know, he's been talking to them all along the way, and as they've come upon different opportunities to perform miracles or to have teachings, whatever, he's talked to them. But there's also been those times where they've been informally on the road, just walking side by side, sometimes in front, sometimes in back, sometimes just next to one another, and just talking about things. Jesus teaching them informally all along the way. But now there's something special that he needs to convey to them. Something that he needs to confide in them. He's not going to tell anybody else about this. He's just going to share this with those disciples. And so when I get there to verse number 17, though they're walking down the road, they stop. And it says that he calls those 12 disciples to himself, and then he begins to teach them. It tells me in this first section that Jesus prophetically revealed his strategy. That's what he's doing with these disciples. He prophetically is revealing his strategy to them. It may not exactly be the strategy that we might think is a winning strategy. Let me show you these four things that are in here as you look in verses 18 and 19. Jesus says, behold, look, stop for a minute. Think about this with me. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priest and to the scribes. It tells me that he already knows what's first on his line of strategy. And that is that a disciple will checkmark him. He knows that somebody's going to check him. Somebody's going to point him out. Somebody's going to identify him. And it's not just going to be just anybody. It's one of his own disciples. One of those that now at this very point are gathered with him on the side of the road as he's teaching them. Do you think Jesus knows who it is? Of course he knows who it is. Do you think Judas knows who it is? I think he may have a little bit of an idea. Let me ask you this. Do you think the other disciples knew it was Judas? If you read the scriptures, they didn't know. They didn't have a clue. Out of all people that they would trust, it was Judas. He was the one that they would give the money to, only to discover that he's also a thief, as much as he is a liar and a betrayer. But Judas is right there in the midst of that little crowd of 13, 12 disciples and Jesus. As he gathers them together and says, behold, stop for a minute. I know we're headed to Jerusalem, but you need to take some time out for this. There's something that's coming that I need to reveal to you. I'm going to be betrayed. Did you know that an enemy can't betray you? In fact, an acquaintance can't betray you. Only someone that you have confidence in, only someone that you've placed trust in, only somebody that you love and that you trust with all of your heart, that's the only one that can betray you. Oh, others can turn you in, others could identify you, others could mark you out in the same way that Judas is going to do that, but nobody else can really betray you. And it seems as if there's not a hurt that hurts quite like betrayal. And yet here Jesus is looking at Peter, looking at James, looking at John, looking at Andrew, looking at Bartholomew, looking at Philip, looking at Nathaniel, looking at all of these guys. And then having to look at Judas and saying, we're headed to Jerusalem. And remember, one of them's already said, Jesus, don't go to Jerusalem. They're going to kill you. Jesus said, I'm going to Jerusalem. He said, well, then I guess we're all going to Jerusalem then. We'll just all die in Jerusalem. We're going to Jerusalem. It's not the death that's the first thing on the schedule. The first thing is the betrayal. He says, a disciple will checkmark me. But then notice what he says. He says that he will betray him to the chief priest and to the scribes. Those that are the Jewish religious elite. They're next on his strategy. A disciple will checkmark him, but the Jews will condemn him. And that's what he says, doesn't it? He says he will be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes, and they, the chief priests and the scribes, the Jewish leaders, those who are religious, those who had the Old Testament, those who read those passages like Isaiah says that the Messiah will come and set his face like a flint to save them. Nothing will stop him is what he's saying. And yet they will be the ones, they, he says, will condemn him to death. They will condemn him. It was unusual. In fact, the disciples themselves might have started scratching their heads because they may have been as astute as we are concerning their own political nature that they lived in and would take notice that the Jews, they don't get to kill anybody. They don't get to put anybody to death. They don't get to execute them. So how is it then that the Jews then will condemn him? And by condemning him means condemning him to die. What is Jesus talking about? That's really not happened before. It's not supposed to happen. And you would think out of all the people in the world, the chief priests and the scribes would recognize that that prophecy, even that one in Isaiah, pointed to Christ. Listen, if a heart's hard, it doesn't matter how many times you show them, does it? When you go out and you start knocking on those doors for Grow Team, you never know who you're gonna meet. I told Haley was with me and Matthew was with me tonight. We met a young lady by the name of Ashlyn. When Ashlyn opened the door, at first I was relieved because finally at least somebody opened the door, you know, would talk to us. And I thought, this lady is not interested at all. You just don't know. You don't. Before we left the visit, Ashlyn had prayed to receive Christ. What a great time there. And I never would have thought that of her. But yet she was ready. She was open. God was doing something in her heart. And Jesus, you would think, he would have thought that those Jews, that God would have been doing something in his heart, in their heart. That they would have been the ones to know and they would have recognized him as Messiah. But they're not going to. And as much as Judas and some of the others may have wanted to hasten this process for Jesus to come on strong and deliver them politically, Judas is ready to side with the scribes and the Pharisees. He's ready to side with the chief priests. Jesus isn't. Be careful of what looks like something on the outside, because you never really know what's going on the inside. There are people that we come into contact with every day, and they need to know Jesus. And they need to know his story. And it's our responsibility to tell them. And are we not? Should we refuse to tell them? Are we not condemning them? Don't I look at this lady? I mean, I knock on the door and she opens the door. And kind of like a tank top kind of thing, I guess, going on. Tattoos are everywhere. Do I condemn her? Do I condemn her for her tattoos? Do I condemn her for the smoke that comes out of the house when the door is opened? You know, I guess I shouldn't say there are things I'm never going to do, but I don't foresee that I'll ever smoke. I don't foresee that I'm ever going to get a tattoo. I don't like pain that much. But it's not my job to condemn, is it? We go with a message of life. That's where those Jewish leaders should have been. Be careful, Baptists, today, that we don't become the Pharisees of the first century, always saying that a person should dress some way or look some way or smell some way or talk some way or act some way, and be discriminate in how we issue the gospel. Everybody needs it. This is Jesus' strategy. He's revealing it to his disciples right there on the roadside. He says a disciple will checkmark him. The Jews will condemn him. Look in verse number 19 and you'll find out that he says that the Gentiles will crucify him. Yep, the Jews are going to be the one to condemn him to death. They're going to turn him over. But it's the Gentiles that they're going to get to do their dirty work. Isn't that interesting? Sinners outside of church do their own dirty work. Sinners inside of church like to let others outside of church take the blame for what they do. Amen or oh me. Verse number 19. He says that after this occurs, he says they will condemn him to death, and then they will deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. All three of those things are going to happen, aren't they? On that Thursday night before Easter, we're going to gather together and we're going to sing songs and we're going to have the Lord's Supper. We're going to have a wonderful time of worship together. It's a really, really special time. I want to tell you something. That Thursday before the first Easter wasn't anything like that. The Thursday before the first Easter, Jesus has supper with his disciples. And he reminds them of these very same things that we're reading here in Matthew chapter 20, telling it to them again. And this time even pointing out who the betrayer is and allowing him to leave early. Jesus is then going to take those disciples and he's going to go to the garden. And he's going to leave some of them a little ways and he's going to take a few of them with him and then he's going to leave them. And then he's going to move on and pray simply by himself. That prayer meeting is going to be interrupted, isn't it? By guards, and specifically by the betrayer. They'll arrest Jesus that night and take him to what's going to be the first of six trials that he'll go through in the next few hours. He'll be on trial before the Jewish leaders. He'll be on trial before Pilate. He'll be on trial before Herod. He'll have Jewish trials. He'll have Roman trials. None of them will be legal. None of them will be by the law. None of them will be trying to seek the truth. And Pilate thinks he's going to have a way to be able to say, save face with the Jews and save face with the Romans by having Jesus scourged. Beaten really within an inch of his life. You know, we often talk about those beatings that they would take and the scourging, and remember that the Old Testament says that a Jewish person couldn't be beaten more than 40 times. And so you know, as well as I know, that they would only whip them 39 times just in case they miscounted. You know, who would want to break the law at that point, right? The Romans didn't have that law. The Jews aren't in charge of the scourging. They've turned him over. It's Pilate and his men that are. They will so beat Jesus that he's not even able to carry his own cross. Something that the other guys could do. In great agony, he's going to the cross where he will be crucified. One nail through both feet, a nail in each wrist. As he hangs there and has to pull on those wrists just to get air in, pulling on those wrists just to get air out, pushing up on those feet. He's not going to hang there long. And he's going to die. And that's what Jesus is trying to tell his disciples. This is my strategy. My strategy is not to win an election. The reality is, it doesn't matter who we put in the White House. That's not our Savior. He's not coming for an election. He's not coming for military conquest. This is the plan. It was plan A, and there never was a plan B. This has been his strategy from the very beginning. It's time for his strategy to be put into practice. And you may look at this and think, along with those disciples, that's the worst strategy I've ever heard. If this is some kind of great strategy to deliver people, how is it that a betraying disciple and a condemning Jewish crowd and a crucifying Gentile crowd, how is that strategy? Look at the end of verse number 19. In the third day he will rise again. Jesus will conquer all. That's the strategy. The strategy is that he would give his life as a ransom for those who needed that life. If they would but trust him, if they would but turn from their sins, they could be reconciled with God, rescued from hell, and rejoice in who and what they are. Can you imagine what that conversation really was like? I can imagine a lot of things about how that conversation ended. The one thing that I could never imagine are the next verses. We're not going to read through all those, but I want you to sometime. The next verses, they're going to get back on the road again. And finally, one's going to come up and say, "Hey, can I sit on your right hand? Can I sit on your left hand? I'm better than these guys." And they start to bicker one with another. You know, that goose and monkey this morning wasn't Baptist, but these guys are, aren't they? I'll tell you what, it's incredible. And rather than turning his attention to those disciples, we see him turning his attention in another direction when you skip down to verse number 29. I told you that there were two of these occurrences that we wanted to look at tonight. In the first one, Jesus prophetically revealed his strategy to his disciples. And then in the second one, Jesus will physically restore the sight of these blind men. Look at what it says there in verse number 29. "Now as they went out of Jericho, a great multitude followed Jesus." So now it's not just the 12, is it? There's a lot of people following him. They're getting closer to Jerusalem, closer and closer. And the closer they get, the bigger the crowd's going to get. "And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out saying, 'Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David.'" When I look at these points in this particular story, what I see is this: they cried to Jesus. They just simply cried out to him. What are they crying for? They're crying for mercy. "Have mercy on us." How many times had they said that day? How many times had they cried that out during their lifetime? How many times on the Sabbath, on the road coming to the temple, would they have sat there and said the very same thing? "Have mercy on us. Have mercy on us." And people simply passed them by. Oftentimes we pass by those that are needy, those who cry out to the Lord. And it may very well be that while they are there crying out to the Lord, the answer that God is sending them is us. And when we pass by without doing anything for them, we may have missed the will of God. We've surely missed the blessing of God. People would have passed him by regularly. You say, "Tim, I don't know. I mean, if they're out there and they're crying out for mercy, surely somebody's going to stop." Well, that somebody may have. But look at this. I want to come back to this phrase about "have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." But look at verse number 31. "The multitude warned them that they should be quiet, but they cried out all the more, saying, 'Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David.'" The multitude around them, those people that saw them every day, the ones that heard them on their way to temple, or the people that were going to work and would hear them say, "Have mercy on us." We're not just saying, "Shh, be quiet. You're being too loud. And if you're being loud, then we can't hear Jesus when he comes by. Shh." It says that they warned them. "You better shut up or else." Right? Now that's a warning. They're warning them. "You need to be quiet." For whatever reason. For whatever reason, maybe so they could hear Jesus, maybe so that they wouldn't hear them. What are the reasons that we pass by? What are the reasons that we give for not listening to the cries of the needy? The answers that we would have, whether we want to admit them or not, are the same answers that they would have about why they would want to shut them down. But they cried to Jesus. And notice that of all the people that are there, the ones who know who Jesus is. at the end of verse number 30 and the end of verse number 31, have mercy on us, O Lord. O Lord. God incarnate, have mercy on us. Do you suppose that they could possibly recognize while they're sitting there on the side of the road and they have been, you know, I would imagine that they've been praying now for years, God, please have mercy on us. Please restore our sight to us. Please restore an ability to make a living. Please restore our families to us. Whatever, I mean, they're crying out, God, please, God, please, God, please. And now, not having sight, but having clear vision, they see what nobody else sees. This is God, and I'm still asking Him the same thing. Have mercy on us, O Lord. It tells me that they recognize that He is the one true one. They recognize what the Jews did not recognize, that He is Messiah. That's the term, Son of David. An analogy back to Messiah. They know that He's Messiah. They know that He's the Son of God. They know that He is able to do this. And so they cry to Jesus. Secondly, I see in this passage that Jesus called to them. In verse number 32, so Jesus stood still and called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? Jesus called to them. Isn't that interesting? That the crowd is warning them, be quiet or else. And yet Jesus calls to them. Just think about it for a minute. The crowd is growing around Jesus. There's a lot of people that are there. If these two blind guys are on the side of the road, it tells me that there's probably other people on the side of the road too that haven't really been following Him, but that are there. It tells me that there are probably scores of people that are there. Why does Jesus call out to people who can't see Him and who can't come to Him? You call your dog so your dog will come, right? Sorry, you call your kids so your kids will come, right? Same thing, just treat them like a dog. They don't mind. You call so they will come. Why does Jesus call? They can't get up and come. But they can hear. They might not be able to see like everybody else saw, but they could hear what nobody else was listening for. Everybody else is caught up in the celebration. They have their eyes affixed, or their ears affixed and attuned to the voice of Jesus. You can come and sit in a worship service on a Sunday morning, a Sunday night, or whenever, and you can get all caught up in the celebration, and you can go out missing the point. But there's some that come and they're ready to hear from God. Their ears are ready. Their hearts have been prepared. They're ready. And these guys are ready. They cried to Jesus. Jesus called to them. Number three, they clarified with Jesus. Jesus asked them the question, didn't He? What do you want me to do for you? And they don't just go, duh. See the sunglasses and the pencils in the box? No. He says, they said to Him, Lord, they've not left that out. Lord, that our eyes may be opened. They've just simply let that request be made known unto God. Do you hang on to that verse? Be anxious for nothing, but in all things, with prayer and supplication, let your request, and with thanksgiving, let your request be made known unto God. And then what? He'll give you everything you want. It's not the next verse, is it? in the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. You know, what if you're the blind man and you're sitting there and you've asked Jesus to open your eyes and he doesn't do it? The question is, will you still trust him? Will you still honor him? Will you still worship him when things don't go your way? You know, there's another blind man that Jesus encountered, and they asked Jesus, they said, well, whose fault is it that he's blind? Is it his fault or is it his parents' fault? He's been blind from birth. And Jesus says, not even one of their faults. This is for the glory of God. And he heals him. What if the glory of God's revealed in not being healed? Is that okay with you? There's some whose faith is not strong enough for a God who provides through the storm rather than a God who provides out of the storm. I think they're just simply making their request known. I don't have any idea what life would be like for them if Jesus just simply said, well, bless you, this is the plan that I have for your life. They just simply let their request be made known, and they trusted him. And then finally, Jesus cured them. Jesus cured them. Look in verse number 34. So Jesus had compassion and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight. And look at this, don't miss it. And they followed him. And they followed him. I don't know how long they've been blind. I don't know if these guys have been blind since birth or not. But let's just imagine that they have been, okay? They've never seen a crowd. They've heard it, but they've never been able to put the picture with it. They've never seen the trees. They've never seen the road. They've never seen the buildings. They've never seen anything. Wouldn't you think that they would be so captivated by a new world that's open to them? Man, they're just amazed. They're just drinking it all in. Look, that's what a building looks like. That's what I keep bumping into. Look at all these people. Everybody's different. I imagine everybody looked the same. But that one's different than that one, and that one, and that one, and that one. I don't know. I don't see it in there, do you? It says, immediately they received their sight, and they followed Jesus. There was only one thing that they needed to see, and that was the one thing that they wanted to see, and that's the Lord. Good things happen by the roadside. I'm going to pray some good things happen to you on the roadside here in the next few weeks.